Support for WPR comes from Wills on behalf of Wisconsin Public Libraries, offering access to ebooks, audiobooks, digital magazines, and more. Available with a Wisconsin Library Card at wisconsinsdigitallibrary.org. Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
But first, Jonathan Gray. Gray is an associate professor of media and cultural studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also the author of Show Sold Separately, Promos, Spoilers, and Other Media Paratexts. Jonathan Gray explains what a media paratext is.
Paratexts are all those things that surround film and TV, or anything else for that matter, a book, a video game, that aren't considered part of the thing itself, but that play a huge role in giving us a sense of what that thing means. So, I mean, just to give you a few examples is the best way to illustrate it. Things like trailers, the posters for a movie, if you hear podcasts or if there are DVD bonus materials, if there's a spin-off toy, if there's a spin-off video game, all those things, as I said, that sort of surround that you would sort of exclude and say, well, that's not the thing itself. But what I was interested in with the book is how those things actually play a key role in determining what the thing itself is.
So how does this differ from hype, from promos, or does that just sort of encompass all of the hype and the promotion and the marketing?
The hype is very much part of it. Why I used the word paratext was because what I wanted to do is sort of focus on what they do in terms of meaning rather than what they do in terms of profit. So when we talk about hype, we're usually referring to, you know, the sort of money-generating aspect of it. And of course, that's why a lot of them exist. But I was also interested in, you know, for instance, when you see a poster for a movie several months before it comes out, how does that start the process of interpreting the movie? How does it start the process of getting us thinking about what is that movie? What are the characters? What kind of world is this set in? So how do we start to imagine the world and the narrative before we've even got there?
In fact, in the introduction to the book, you even said, and I'll quote to you, I think this is right, "While many consumers deride the presence of hype and licensed merchandise as a nuisance, we also rely upon it, at least in part, to help us get through an evening's viewing or a trip to the multiplex." And I was thinking about that, and it's true that without that, you don't know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
And with it, sometimes you understand more than you would if you had to rely entirely on what the thing itself is going to give you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the other day I went and saw a movie, and as is the case, you know, there were something like 9 previews beforehand. And at the end of that, I had a sense of one of those 9 films being something I wanted to watch, one that I guess I could watch, and 7 that, you know, I'd rather you do horrible things to me than make me watch because it looked like they'd be a horrible thing. And so, you know, it was an important way of me making a decision. And for the one that I'm interested in, I now have a sense of sort of, you know, who are those characters? What kind of world we're living in? The world's already sort of started for me. There's a sort of nugget of a narrative and of something that I might engage with.
Sometimes it's more than a nugget too, isn't it? I mean, sometimes the trailer that you see for a movie is actually all you'd really want to see that movie.
The Onion News Network, the great satirist, they have a wonderful instance of this where they did a thing about playing with the idea that the Iron Man trailer was so good that I think it was Paramount Pictures had decided that they were going to make a full-length movie based on this trailer.
Apparently, the plan is to expand that fast montage of very short shots seen in the trailer into full-length, distinct scenes. And in between those scenes, they plan to add additional scenes that weren't in the trailer.
Just doesn't seem like that would work.
That's right. The fact is, it's very difficult to make the character, story, action that work in a 90-second format also work when they're stretched out to 80 or 90 minutes.
Why do you think the trailer was so popular?
Well, it does tell an amazing story, Michael. A cocksure billionaire industrialist and inventor is kidnapped, but turns on his captors by designing an amazing mechanized suit of armor, ultimately becoming a hero to the world. It is a breathtaking 90-second thrill ride.
Sure. Surely then, Paramount realizes the tremendous financial risk of alienating the trailer's core fan base if they don't embrace the film properly.
Exactly,
and
that's why the studio has tried to reassure the public that everything that they love about the trailer will be incorporated into the movie adaptation, right down to actual lines from the trailer. And they are bringing Robert Downey Jr. back to reprise his role as Tony Stark.
Well, there would have been a real outcry if they had tried to cast someone else.
Yes.
what they were playing with was the fact that it was a brilliant trailer. Many people watched it. It looked great. But the question was, could the movie actually live up to this trailer? And we've probably all seen these examples with comedies, right, where they're super funny and yet you go then go and watch the movie and the only funny lines in the movie were in the trailer.
Yeah, that's actually sort of disturbing when it happens to you. And I don't know entirely whether it's because you already knew all of those jokes. Mm-hmm. If you hadn't had them beforehand, would they have been funnier as they came up in context?
Well, and also you end up wondering whether you were duped. There was a really interesting article in the New Yorker a while back where they did a profile of a guy who works for Lionsgate Entertainment hyping all of their films. And they gave the example of when he was hyping W, the Oliver Stone film. It was marketed very much as a sort of Michael Moore kind of irreverent, we're going to really attack George W. Bush. But in fact, if anyone saw the movie, it depicts Bush as kind of a tragic figure. And so people who saw the hype would have expected something very different. But part of what this profile was looking at was how this guy said, there are two separate things. One is what happens when you're in the cinema. One is how I get you to the cinema. And I stand by my choices, even if they have nothing to do with the film. That's it's going to get you there.
Well, and of course, that's what he's trying to accomplish, except for the eventual payoff, which may hurt him. If you watch too many of these things, the next time you'll say, well, that's another Oliver Stone film. I don't think it's going to be what I expected it to be because the trailer last time misled me.
Yeah, no, I mean, this can start to kick back on itself. And I mean, trailer rhetoric is so common that it's very easy to parody it, as with the example I told you of The Onion. I also think if there's a popular video you could look up on YouTube, I think it's the trailer for every movie. And it's just a sort of trailer for the quintessential Oscar-winning movie, and it introduces all the characters. It has the set pieces of music.
A naive yet inspiring statement. And the music gets hopeful.
Specific outlining of your major character flaws.
Overreaction.
Friendly black optimistic advice.
Passionately! Whisper repetition.
This scene doesn't make it to the final cut of the movie.
Inspiring final lines of a speech that douchebags will quote in their Facebook profiles!
There really are only a few pieces of music that we hear in trailers, like Salisbury Hill or the Requiem for a Dream song that became most famous when it was used in the trailer for The Lord of the Rings and then gets used in pretty much every action movie since then. They use the same techniques over and over again.
I was actually thinking about it, especially with Lord of the Rings. The whole DVD extra thing was integrated from the beginning of the filmmaking process. But it made me wonder whether the books have now become paratext for the movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative.
I wonder what Tolkien would think of that.
Exactly. He's been relegated for some people. As I said, it's relative to who the individual is. I don't doubt that there are some people out there who grown up, I'd include myself in this group, grown up being Lord of the Rings fans of the books, and the films will only ever be a sort of part of the books. But for many other people out there, the books are just sort of reduced to a footnote now, and it's the movies that come first and foremost.
I remember having a surprising discussion with my son, who's in his 30s now, and he has never read the books.
Oh.
But he loves the movies.
Sacrilege.
I agree completely, but there you are.
Yeah, well, and I mean, what's interesting too is even if you know that the book came first, we don't always experience it that way. I remember the first time I read Mario Puzo's Godfather, and I was fascinated because it gave me a whole new line on a bunch of the characters from the film, and I knew that the novel had come first, but I didn't experience it first.
One of the other things that you talk about is the new business of alternate reality games, of video games, which are a different kind of paratext.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's gone on there is you get a bunch of producers who grew up with Star Wars toys and with all these other things and realize how important they were. And so now when they're writing their stories, they realize, wait, why do I just have to write the story in the film? Or why do I just have to write a TV show? I want to do the spin-off comic. I want to have a hand in making the video game. I want to create this world that flows between different media. And so, as you said, with several of these shows, you can go online and you find, you know, web pages that are in-world. So, you know, for Lost, there was this mysterious fictional organization called the Hanso Foundation, and you could go to the Hanso Foundation's website. And so you get this sort of experience of stepping into the world, and the writers are sort of having fun with this, telling a story across different venues.
I would imagine there'd be some problems with that, though. The temptation to leave part of the story out so that you can tell it in a different venue could end up harming the essence of the story, which was to have begun all of this.
This is often called transmedia. For those people who create transmedia, it's a really hard issue. You can think of the Matrix films as an example. You know, the Matrix 1 was very successful, and then the Wachowski brothers, who wrote the Matrix, in writing number 2 and number 3, got this idea that they'd like to thread it through the video game and through other properties that surround it. The problem was they put information into the video game that would have helped the movie. And they had a little too much trust and faith that the audience wanted to experience all of those things. Some people just wanted to go and watch a movie, and they didn't feel that they had to do homework before the movie, and they weren't into games, and they didn't want to go there. And so it's a real challenge. You know, if you do want to tell a story over multiple media, how do you do it in a way that makes it important for those people who do go to those other venues, but doesn't make it so important that those who don't feel like they're missing out on something.
So where do you see it going now? Where is paratext headed?
I don't know. I think we're going to continue to see people trying to experiment with this. I think where it'll work is in places where it has worked, like Lord of the Rings or Star Wars, these large universes where it's quite okay to cut off one segment of it, and we don't need to know about every segment of it as a reader or as a viewer to engage with another segment. If you imagine a narrative as a line, there's always going to be a problem with that model. If you need to get one piece of information before you can move to the next space on the line, that's going to be a no-win situation for storytelling. Whereas if storytelling is a three-dimensional model and you can go in a variety of different directions, then there's perhaps a little more scope for all of these other things to be part of the storytelling process.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of when the web began to first take on the aspect that we've all become familiar with. Mm. And it was filled with hypertext links that would take you away from the story that you were in. Often you never ended up back on the page where you started.
Yeah, it's the danger that we're always moving to the next and never finishing where we began.
Right. At least with paratext in the way that you've been describing it, there is an original body of work about which all of the rest of this is built.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the pluses, I guess, of there being a profit incentive behind a lot of it, is that because ultimately the people who are creating this want you to get back to what they often call the mothership, because that's where they make most of their money, they'll try to create it in a way that brings you back to that sort of central point. If there was less of that, we might be sort of lost in the wilderness with each of us reading a very different part. It sort of would be like the experience of ripping a novel into its many pages and giving each reader one page. And no one could be on the same page, quite literally.
Jonathan Gray is the author of Show Sold Separately, Promos, Spoilers, and Other Media Paratexts.